Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. You know, I realized, I don't know why exactly this happened, but in the last couple months, I feel like we have been really focusing on the animal kingdom. That wasn't by design. I guess we just can't stop with the things with legs and blood.
Well, I think maybe what's happening is that we have, without realizing it, been constructing a manger, a nativity scene.
Oh, okay.
And of course, you have to have your various animals present. And so we've been arranging the animal.
Oh, and I guess others bearing gifts of nursery web spider style wrapped up packages of dead insect husks and sticks and stuff. I don't know who the shepherds would be.
Well, whatever the shepherds are, we know that at the heart of the nativity, you have to have that baby Jesus. Uh-huh. And granted, we did an episode last year on the baby Jesus homunculus, and that is rerunning this year. But at the heart of this story, of the Christmas story in Christian traditions, is the story of a virgin birth.
Now, the story of a miraculous birth, of course, is very common in mythology and legend around the world. A god being the father of a famous or heroic person is a very common motif to appear. Why settle for an earth dad when you can have a cosmic dad?
Yeah, it's a time-tested story, right? You have your demigod heroes that have at least one parent that is of divine lineage. Now, before we go any further, I do want to just summarize the Christmas story as it's presented in Christian traditions just really quickly here. So, it's probably familiar to a lot of you. You have a first century BCE woman by the name of Mary, and she finds out via angelic visitation that she's destined to become a first century CE mom. And not in the way she'd planned. No, instead of producing offspring via relations with her husband Joseph, she has been impregnated by the high God. She is a virgin but will give birth to a divine son.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, this is not an anomaly in global myths, legends, and religions. We have other stories of some sort of miraculous birth taking place.
Right. And what we wanted to focus on today was the fact that though this may in fact be some form of miracle if it were to actually happen to a human being, in other corners of the natural world, stories like this are actually not all that miraculous. They in fact happen all the time.
Right. So today we're going to be talking about parthenogenesis. That is the scientific term for what's occurring here. It's taken from the Greek words parthenos, meaning virgin, and genesis, meaning origin.
So this means in the animal world, or in the world of sexually reproducing species, a female that reproduces without fertilization by male sex cells.
Right. And it occurs pretty commonly among lower plants and invertebrate animals, particularly rotifers, aphids, ants, wasps, and bees. I do want to hit just two of my favorite examples from the invertebrate world. First of all, in the termite world, as pointed out in a 2009 research paper from North Carolina State University, certain female termite primary queens of the species Reticulotermes separatus reproduce both sexually and asexually during their lifetimes, sexually with the male kings and asexually to essentially clone themselves to create secondary queens.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the successor queens that will then mate with the king. So it's important for them to have no genes in common with them.
Okay.
So that's just, a fun example of, all right, well, here you can clearly see in this picture why it is advantageous to use asexual reproduction alongside sexual reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the greatest benefit of sexual reproduction is that you get some variety in there. You don't have a stagnant gene pool.
Right, sexual recombination. If you're just making copies of your own genes over and over again, it becomes much easier for, say, parasites to find exploits with your body. But if you're constantly randomly recombining your genes with other members of your species, then you add some diversity to the mix and give yourself more room to more genetic wiggle room.
It's kind of like, say, Hollywood made the same movie for 10 years straight, like the same, say, superhero movie, just the same one time after time. And it was a really tremendous design. Everyone loved it. But then suddenly everyone decides, you know, I'm not that into superhero movies anymore. Bam, an entire decade wasted.
Right.
That's a very loose explanation. But
that's why you get the genre mix up. Throw some zombies in there. No, now you got a whole new thing.
Now it's fresh again. Yeah. And now people will get into it. Here's another example that I love. This is probably my absolute favorite. It's a particular type of Amazonian ant, Mycokeperus smithii. Like Alan Smithy, speaking of films. This is a fungi-growing species that's not unlike the leafcutter ant. Mm-hmm. And they've actually given up on sexual reproduction altogether and have become an all-female species. Mm-hmm. It's a colony of clones, so they're a lot more efficient in some ways, but they're highly vulnerable due to their lack of genetic diversity. But they're an example of a species that took a reproductive tactic that existed in balance with sexual reproduction and eventually made it their own means, their only means of reproduction.
Now, while this might be more common, and of course, asexual reproduction is the norm among, say, like single-celled organisms.
Right.
But while it may be more common among invertebrates and these sort of what are considered lower order animals, though I don't know if it really makes sense to consider them lower or higher. What does lower or higher mean? But anyway, it is going to be more surprising to find something like this in vertebrates, which we normally would expect to be sexually reproducing animals. You've got a backbone, you should be having sex, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's why it's such a rarity. Roughly 70 backbone species have been known to engage in parthenogenesis or exhibit parthenogenesis. That's roughly 0.1% of all vertebrates. Now, just a few basic categories of parthenogenesis before we move on to specific examples. There's accidental. This is spontaneous parthenogenesis.
It's not part of the plan.
Not part of the plan, but it does occur. And one example we'll see of that later is in sharks. There's also facultative. This is when a female can produce offspring either sexually or via asexual reproduction. This is a common example, but one that we'll look at here in a minute is Komodo dragons. And then there's obligate. This is exclusive asexual reproduction. That doesn't mean that a given species can't use sexual reproduction, but it's certainly not their primary means of reproduction. Think of various invertebrates as an example of this, including the ants that I mentioned earlier.
Single-sex species.
Yes, especially single-sex species.
Well, let's take a look at those Komodo dragons.
Yeah.
So the Komodo dragon, which is Varanus komodoensis, is, of course, the largest lizard species in the world. And Robert, I don't know about you, but this was one of my favorite animals when I was a kid. I could not get enough of them. I love pictures of them. I think I would actually, if I could get like a National Geographic with a picture of one, I would cut it out. I seem to have some memories of that.
Oh, yeah. Because it's the closest thing you can get to a storybook dinosaur. Like not counting
kinda,
in.
Yeah.
But not getting into like, the evolution of avian species and all that. But just in terms of like, I want a giant lizard creature like I see in my children's books, this is the closest you're going to get. So, yeah, I remember being super into it. I remember being like weirdly excited when Kim Basinger? Sharon Stone's husband was bitten by one. I just remember it being in the.
Oh, yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. And yeah, not to make light of that. I mean, I'm thinking it now, it's probably horrific, but I remember at the time it was like, oh my goodness, the Komodo dragons are coming after our celebrities. Like there was something weirdly exciting about that. And yet at the same
time. What if they get Richard Gere?
No, not Richard Gere. He's a national treasure. But. In terms of seeing them in zoos, though, this is one of those animals that is both impressive and boring to see in most zoos because it's a cold-blooded creature. It's just going to be sitting there most of the time, an impressive organism, but very little movement unless you're lucky. At the same time, there's some tremendous footage of them in the wild. If you've watched any of the BBC Earth documentaries, you've seen some of this footage of the active Komodo dragon, and there's nothing more terrifying than watching them say move in on a vulnerable cow that is trapped in the mud.
Have you ever watched them doing acrobatic barfing?
Oh, they are quite adept at barfing, aren't they?
Unbelievable barfing. Mm-hmm. Like I've seen footage of them barfing where it looks like they barf up more than their own body mass.
They are also, I remember one of the notable things about them is that they will sling intestines around to remove the fecal matter from them so they can eat the intestines.
Oh, okay. I don't think I've read that, but I think maybe I've heard you mention that before.
Yeah, yeah. They're voracious eaters. The young Komodo dragons have to hide from the adults so they don't get eaten. I believe they climb trees, and of course the grown-ups cannot really go after them.
Yes, they can be quite aggressive even to one another. So this species, they live on a number of islands in Indonesia, and as adults, they get huge. They can grow up to about 3 meters or 10 feet in length. Actually, I think the largest one ever I read was even bigger than that. It was like 10.3 feet in length, and they can weigh over 130 kilograms or about 300 pounds. Again, I think I read that the biggest one ever measured was something like 360 pounds.
Wow.
They are venomous. They deliver a bite that prevents the prey's blood from clotting. However, they do not primarily hunt live prey, but get the majority of their diet from scavenging dead or dying animals, though, of course, they do also hunt. And when they hunt live prey, those prey species can be all kinds of things, mainly deer. I think deer is the biggest one, mm-hmm. but also bovines, pigs, rodents, monkeys, goats. And they have on occasion, as we said, attacked and killed humans. But this does not make them our enemy. These are magnificent, scaly beasts, and they themselves are threatened. In conservation status terms, you know, like you got the IUCN classifications, they are not yet considered endangered, but they are considered vulnerable. According to the WWF, there are only about 6,000 left on Earth and only about 350 breeding females.
Oh, wow.
And for that reason, there are these conservation and captivity breeding efforts going on around the world. But so I want to tell a Komodo dragon story. In 2005, a female Komodo dragon named Sungai was living at the London Zoo, and that year she produced a clutch of 22 eggs, four of which were viable. But there was a problem. It had been 2.5 years since Sungai had been anywhere near a male Komodo dragon. So in order to explain her laying these eggs, it would seem she either had to somehow store sperm from a male for over 2 years, which is technically possible sometimes in reptiles. There are like sperm storage methods that sometimes happen. Or she had performed parthenogenesis. And her eggs hatched 7.5 months after she laid them, and her offspring seemed healthy. In 2006, a female Komodo dragon named Flora was living at the Chester Zoo in the UK, and she was at the time one of only two sexually mature female Komodos in the whole continent of Europe. As I said, you know, many zoos around the world do these Komodo dragon breeding programs to try to help get the numbers back up. And at the time, Flora had not been breeding. In fact, she had never even once been kept in an enclosure with a male. Nevertheless, in 2006, she produced a clutch of 25 eggs, and 11 seemed viable at first. So what could explain this? I mean, you have to wonder, was there like a male Komodo dragon running loose in England, secretly getting into the pens when nobody's watching? And if we do entertain that possibility, we have to name that English Komodo dragon. What was his name?
Ooh, I don't know. A rogue English Komodo dragon.
That'd be Rupert, right?
Rupert, or maybe kind of – if he's kind of a Robin Hood type figure, he could be a Komodo Hood Robin – I don't know. It's not
Clive.
Working.
He's Clive.
Clive is a good name,
okay,
yes.
So Clive – did Clive get in there or did something else happen? Turns out it was not Clive. So there was a paper published in Nature in 2006 by Watts, Booley, Sanderson, Boardman, Siofi, and Gibson called Parthenogenesis in Komodo Dragons. And the authors here performed genetic fingerprinting tests on the eggs of these dragons. And they found that in both cases, the offspring were what are known as parthenogens, which are made entirely out of their own mother's DNA rather than through sexual recombination with a male. And in the case of Flora, this was true virgin birth. But in both cases, they had created baby Komodo dragons without the help of a male. So the authors note that the offspring were homozygous at all loci on their genome, but that they were not identical clones of their mothers. So how would that work? Well, you've got to think about what happens in sexual recombination of an animal like this. So the mother contributes half of her genome, and the father contributes half of his genome, and they combine to produce a mix of the two. And in this case, the mother still only contributed half of her genome. So in order to produce an entire genome in the offspring without any male input, the mother's half set of chromosomes simply doubled itself. So the offspring are not clones of the mother. They're homozygous at all loci. So everywhere you look on their genome, there's a double copy of the same allele. all made from half of the mother's genes. But so how does this happen? I was wondering, what are the actual mechanics here? There's a pretty good summary in a Scientific American article from the time by Philip Yam. And Yam writes, quote, "Evidently, in the case of these Komodos, the doubling of the egg genes occurred when, in essence, another egg, rather than sperm, did the job of fertilization. Oogenesis, the biological process of making an egg cell, typically also yields a polar body, a mini ovum of sorts, containing a duplicate copy of egg DNA. Normally, this polar body shrivels up and disappears. In the case of the Komodos, though, polar bodies evidently acted as sperm and turned ova into embryos." So it's like the egg cell had a little copy of itself there with it that would normally shrivel up and go away, but instead it pretended it was sperm and then fertilized its own copy.
Oh, wow.
Another thing, after producing some offspring parthenogenically, the one Komodo dragon sun guy went on to produce a normal clutch of eggs with a male named Raja. So the researchers also concluded that parthenogenesis is not a fixed reproductive trait that lasts forever in the Komodo dragons. You can go back and forth. So, in fact, the findings suggest that this is probably a form of reproductive plasticity. It's the ability to switch between sexual reproduction and asexual reproduction when mates are not available. Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you can see why this would be a tremendous survival advantage. In particular, when you have a case where a female is not exposed to males at all for an extended period of time and yet is capable of producing viable eggs. Like, if there's no male around, this show still has to start one way or another.
Yeah. Now, there are some reasons you might think that there are genetic drawbacks to that. In fact, the authors write that there is a downside to this discovery. Quote, "Parthenogenesis presents a previously unrecognized problem for the genetic management of threatened populations. Why would this be? Well, in captive breeding programs designed to help Komodo dragons build their numbers back up, females are often kept isolated from males, and males are only brought in occasionally for the obvious reason. There are good reasons to do it like this. Like, sometimes these animals are aggressive toward one another, and you don't want them unnecessarily fighting or injuring one another, that kind of thing. But this means that if you keep females in all-female environments with no mates, they may spontaneously give birth to parthenogens. Now, what's wrong with that? Why wouldn't that just help increase their numbers even more? Well, it doesn't quite work like that. The problem is, parthenogenesis reduces the fitness of the Komodo dragon gene pool. The authors write, quote, "A pressing concern with parthenogenesis is instantaneous homozygosity of the entire genome, as this inbreeding carries an associated risk of reduced fitness and an increased probability of extinction." And then there's another problem with the parthenogenesis, and it's that it biases the sex ratio of the offspring. Mm. The authors write, quote, "In Varana species, females have dissimilar chromosomes, Z and W, sort of like human chromosomes, sex chromosomes, X and Y," continuing with their quote, "whereas the combination ZZ produces males, so the parthenogenic mechanism can produce only homozygous ZZ or WW individuals and therefore no females." So the parthenogenesis in the Komodo dragons, because of the way their sex cells work, they can only make male offspring. It's sort of the opposite of the way like human sex chromosomes work, that males have an XY chromosome and females in humans have an XX chromosome. Mm-hmm. In the dragons, it's the other way around. The males have the same two sex chromosomes and the females have the two different sex chromosomes. If you can only make a duplicate copy, you can only make new male dragons.
Yeah, and this is important to keep in mind as we move forward, because we're going to see, the exact chromosomal situation is going to play into what kind of offspring are produced by a given species' propensity for parthenogenesis.
Yes. So back to that question about whether this is useful in the wild, it does seem like it's probably an adaptation, right? For the reason you mentioned earlier, assume a wild female Komodo dragon finds herself isolated on an island environment. Maybe she gets washed up somewhere after a storm. Mm-hmm. She could help her genes survive by parthenogenically producing a clutch of males with which to mate and establish a new colony. Genetically, this is not ideal, but it's better than nothing.
Right.
But it's not good for the dragon populations that are, you know, trying to be sustained right now, for the females to be laying clutches exclusively of essentially inbred males. This may be better than nothing in the wild when there are no males present, like we said, but it actually interferes with the breeding programs that conservationists are using to help, like, replenish the species. So this leads to the idea that, hey, maybe we should be careful about keeping female dragons in isolation in captivity, because when there's no male around, this can happen, and it's not actually what's best for the species if we can help it.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because it's easy to just on the surface of things think, yeah, go, well, way to go, Komodo dragons. Just reproduce whether there's a male around or not. But
well, it is better than nothing, mm-hmm. probably. I mean, if there literally is no male to reproduce with, this makes sense to do. But the problem is, in these cases, it's not actually that there's no male. It's just there's no male right now.
Right.
And by the way, it does appear that other female Komodo dragons in captivity have shown this same phenomenon. Since the initial batch of observations, for example, it was reported in 2008 that healthy male dragons hatched at the Sedgwick County Zoo in Wichita, Kansas, from a female who had not mated with a male. But Komodo dragons are certainly not the only reptiles that exhibit parthenogenesis. Some lizards are even obligate parthenogens, you mentioned earlier, the ones that have no choice. Like the hybrid New Mexico whiptail lizard, this is an all-female species, and there's no sexual reproduction whatsoever. Or, well, actually, what is true is that there is no sexual fertilization. Because, in fact, these lizards have been observed to perform a series of same-sex female courtship and mating rituals, the biological function of which is an interesting subject that we could return to in the future. And I guess it's just a reminder that even in the animal world, the fact that you don't have to have sexual fertilization doesn't mean that there's not sexual behavior.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll get into another reptilian species that exhibits virgin birth.
All right, we're back. So we've been talking about Komodo dragons. We mentioned lizards, reptiles that exhibit parthenogenesis. Snakes are another great source of examples of parthenogenesis. There is at least one species of snake called Indotyphlops brahminus, also known as the Brahminy blind snake, which appears to be an obligate parthenogen. It's a burrowing blind snake, so you'll find it, you know, down underneath the soil and rotten wood and leaf litter and stuff like that. It's found naturally in parts of Africa and Asia, though it has been introduced in other places. And as far as we know, all members of this species are female, and they reproduce completely without sex.
Wow.
However, plenty of other snake species have been shown to exhibit facultative parthenogenesis, like the Komodo dragons. It appears to be some kind of adaptation. Now, apparently for a while, this had only been observed in captive snakes that were living in, you know, in tanks or in zoos or mm-hmm. something like that. So it was believed to be some sort of captive syndrome. But more recently, it appears that facultative parthenogenesis has been observed in wild snakes, sometimes even when males are present. Just to cite one example by Booth, Smith, Eskridge, Haas, Mendelssohn, and Schutt. Facultative parthenogenesis discovered in wild vertebrates in Biology Letters in 2012. These researchers used, quote, microsatellite DNA genotyping and litter characteristics to determine that there was evidence of facultative parthenogenesis in snakes in the wild, in populations of wild North American pit viper snakes like the copperhead and the cottonmouth.
Oh, wow.
So the world may yet be full of asexually reproducing copperhead queens.
Well, that's amazing. Now, we've talked about two different reptile species. I think it's time to move on to the birds.
Okay.
And not just any bird, but a bird that we've discussed a fair amount on Stuff to Blow Your Mind, especially given that we've never devoted – have we devoted an entire episode to them before? Did we do an episode on the turkey?
No, I think we've mostly talked about turkeys in the context of Benjamin Franklin electrocuting them.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's the main reason they keep coming up.
Though that's come up more than once.
Yeah. Well, we're bringing up turkeys again because parthenogenesis has been observed in several bird species, though it usually results in non-viable embryos that never become adults. And the turkey is one of them. Reports of turkeys exhibiting virgin births, these began to roll in, especially in the 1800s, and it received a fair amount of attention in the decades to follow. Breeders were particularly interested because, potential pitfalls aside, and we've discussed what those are regarding stagnant gene pools and all, they really liked the idea of one prize turkey creating another prize turkey without muddying the genetics.
What a horror.
Yeah, but we're talking about the poultry industry here, right?
Yeah, so, the shadowy mechanical priests of poultry science.
Yes. So according to studies in the 70s and 90s in particular, 32 to 49% of infertile eggs may initiate development, but most embryos die at an early stage. Parthenogenesis has also been observed in domestic hens, Chinese painted quails, and the zebra finch. For the turkey, however, it's only going to result in a viable offspring in extreme situations. And when it does result in an actual hatchling, the turkey is always male due to sex chromosome dominance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was looking around for some more information about this, and I realized, well, the best place to look is probably the world of agricultural sciences and animal sciences. And indeed, I found a wonderful overview of this from Thomas F. Savage, PhD, professor and head advisor at the Department of Animal Sciences, Oregon State University in Corvallis. And he points out that parthenogenesis in turkeys, it all comes down to environmental and genetic factors.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, the environmental factors that he outlines here. Age, he says there's a higher rate in younger hens. And then there's also a viral influence here.
Mm-hmm.
There's an increased occurrence in turkey hens exposed to certain diseases, such as Newcastle disease, fowl pox, et cetera. Also, it can be affected by what you're feeding them. There are certain additives used to enhance reproductive efficiency that can stimulate parthenogenic development, specifically the yeast culture Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And then also inactivated or irradiated sperm. In experiments, they found that if they had this irradiated sperm, it was unable to contribute genetically, but it could lead to a higher rate of parthenogenesis.
Oh, because it could stimulate the egg to start dividing, but it wouldn't actually provide genetic material.
Right. Yeah, that's my understanding of it. Also, temperature even. Elevated pre-incubation egg storage temperatures can play a role. And in all these, again, we're talking about increasing the likelihood of it occurring,
mm-hmm.
Not necessarily like a trigger switch exactly. And then there are genetic aspects as well. Some genetic strains just have a predisposition for it, and you can actually increase the chances via genetic selection. And this was proved out in a 1965 study by this guy Olson, who, when you look at
he's the turkey parthenogenesis guy.
Yeah, he is. It's you look at who has done research about it, and it'll be various names, and then like 20 something different search results for this Olson guy. All right, so that's turkeys, and I imagine some of you out there listening to this podcast have some experience with turkeys, or at least hens. Maybe you can write in and give us your take on parthenogenesis in the turkey world.
Now, not to downplay the dangers of turkeys, but I think we should go to a little bit of wilder territory.
Yes.
Can you give me a thrill ride, Robert?
Yeah, let's talk about parthenogenesis in sharks.
Okay.
And also we'll get into rays a little bit. This is actually – I believe this is a topic that Mara Hart who wrote Sex and the Sea, touched on a little bit when she appeared on the program in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certainly going to cite her book, Sex and the Sea, because it is a tremendous book about the wild world of reproduction in Earth's oceans. But yes, as it happens, sharks have been observed to engage in facultative parthenogenesis. It's not obligatory, and it creates offspring genetically distinct from the mother or sibling species. So these are not outright clones. This was first observed in sharks back in 2007 when a study by Chapman et al. Conducted tests on bonnethead sharks born in captivity. The female in this scenario had been isolated from males for more than 3 years, and it turned out that they were able to produce without any male DNA. Also in 2007, Chapman and his team found evidence of parthenogenesis in female black-tip sharks, these in captivity for 9 years without access to males. And a female black-tip, what happened is it died in captivity with a near-term embryo inside it.
Hmm.
Zebra sharks and white spotted shark cases have also been confirmed, and Chapman and his team have also found genetic evidence for hammerhead virgin birth as well. So the ability seems like it might be pretty common, actually, from big sharks to little sharks, from egg layers to live birthers. But does it happen in the wild, or is it just something that occurs in captivity? We're encountering a similar situation that we have with the study of Komodo dragons. Like, is this something that is actually occurring in the wild? And if so, how can we study it? It's actually pretty hard to study in the wild, though, because to do so, you really need to look at the DNA of the mother. You need to look at the DNA of the offspring. And the thing about shark, the world of shark parents, is that they're pretty much donezo after the birth. You know, the parents are not going to hang around and look after the baby sharks.
Not big into nurturing.
Right, yeah. Now, Chapman and other researchers, they have found examples of parthenogenesis in the critically endangered small-tooth sawfish, which is threatened by overfishing and the loss of mangrove habitats. Now, it's technically a ray. It's not a shark, but it winds up in shark fin soup a lot, according to Mara J. Hart in her book, Sex in the Sea. This creature's population has declined, she says, more than 95% since the 1960s. Now, meanwhile, we have Dr. Jim Gelsleichter, who has conducted tests using an ultrasound wand, which he himself describes as looking like a Ghostbusters proton pack.
Uh-huh.
It's a pretty expensive piece of equipment, but that's how they can bring it out into the field, because it's quite a production they have to go through here. They have to catch the ray, they have to keep it by the side of the boat, and then they have to use the wand on it to see what's going on inside it.
What do they find with that wand?
Well, the thing is that they have confirmed parthenogenesis.
Uh-huh.
Now, there are a couple of things I should note here. One is that investigations regarding sharks and rays, they can be complicated for the same reason the Komodo dragon situation is complicated, in that you have to ask yourself, well, are they storing sperm from a previous encounter?
Mm-hmm.
And that can sometimes be the case with sharks and rays. But in the case of the sawfish, this is an example where this amazing adaptation could prove vital in helping them bounce back from the brink of extinction while new protections are in place. Because they're at a point now where, again, they're threatened by overfishing and habitat loss, but certain legal protections have been put in place. And so parthenogenesis could be the tool that helps them reach a sustainable level while those protections are in place. However, over the generations, it's likely going to negatively impact the species' hopes for survival as well. So again, it's that similar scenario with the Komodo dragons. It's better than nothing, but it is also potentially genetically devastating.
So the reasons would be what? That it limits genetic diversity. Essentially, it's similar to inbreeding.
Right.
And that it produces sex bias in the offspring. In this case, they would be almost always female offspring.
Yes, I believe so. But think of it. It would be terrible, wouldn't it? Your species bounces back from the brink of extermination,
mm-hmm.
and you're able to do so via this miraculous virgin birth. But then some sort of disease just wipes all of you out because you lack the genetic diversity to survive it.
Yeah.
And this is actually outside of the world of parthenogenesis. This is something that is encountered too in efforts to restore certain species to the wild.
Yeah.
Like if a population becomes too shallow, then you're not going to have the genetic diversity to really have as robust a genetic presence for the species.
Yeah, but when you're that low as a species, you're in a tough situation anyway. So best of luck to the parthenogens.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take one more break. When we come back, we're going to ask the question, what about parthenogenesis in mammals?
All right, we're back. So we've been discussing parthenogenesis in sharks, in reptiles, in birds. One thing that is certainly true is that you're going to find way fewer examples of this in mammals. In fact, if what I've read is correct, there are no known wild examples of parthenogenesis in mammals. There have been examples that have been induced under synthetic lab conditions, but we've never found an example out in the world.
That's correct. That's what I was finding as well. The only mammalian examples that we run across are ones in human-created myths and legends and religious stories.
Yeah.
So I was reading an article titled Parthenogenesis, Birth of a New Lineage or Reproductive Accident by Caspar J. van der Koe from the University of Groningen and Tanja Schwander. And this was published in Current Biology in 2015. And the authors, they make an interesting choice, an entertaining choice, in directly approaching the birth of Jesus Christ.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's a dangerous move in a biology paper.
I was hesitant to incorporate too much nativity story into this episode. But then the scientists did it, so I can only follow them. And in fact, I want to read a quote from this paper.
Okay.
Quote, this reference to parthenogenesis, and by this reference they're referring to the nativity story,
okay,
is unusual in two ways. First, it is the only account of, quote-unquote, natural parthenogenesis in a mammal. Mammals are believed to be completely unable to reproduce via parthenogenesis because of a number of developmental and genetic constraints. Second, while the Blessed Virgin Mary might have been able to conceive a daughter via parthenogenesis, the conception of a son is highly unlikely. As male sex in humans is determined by genes on the Y chromosome, Mary, as a woman, could not have transmitted any Y chromosomes to her offspring. In contrast to humans, parthenogenetic production of sons is expected in species with other types of sex determination.
Yeah, so that's dealing with the opposite of the Komodo dragons issue we talked about earlier.
Right. Now, I have to say, I can't help but think of certain late medieval traditions in which Christ is illustrated or described in terms of feminine qualities. and this is, based in the idea that it's, an expression of the feminine characteristics of Christ's nature, and of course has nothing to do with genetics or even any sort of egalitarian ideal. But yet, I can't help but think about that when we're thinking about, yes, Mary could have, genetically speaking, had this virgin offspring, but it would have had to have been a female.
Now, I assume that they are just having a little bit of fun with the subject.
Oh,
yes. They're not like trying to say, how can we explain the story of Jesus' birth? Let's try to go to the science of parthenogenesis.
I feel it's kind of like in the same way that we talked about papers about hemorrhoids. They feel they just have to mention the Ark of the Covenant just because you can get a little bit of Bible flavoring in there.
Right.
It's kind of hard to resist incorporating the story of the birth of the Christ child into your paper on genetics and parthenogenesis.
Yes, I can certainly imagine that temptation. But so they're not actually saying this story is a historical record and we're going to explain how it happened biologically.
Right, correct. So they point out a lot of what we've been talking about already, that male-producing parthenogenesis is rare, female-producing parthenogenesis is widespread and mostly obligate, though only a few examples in vertebrates, and there are no examples among mammals. And then there's this whole issue with the female or the male offspring. They say that accidental parthenogenesis is the method that can produce male offspring due to the way that chromosomes come together, but that, quote, the developmental and genetic constraints in humans and other mammals would most likely prevent the emergence of adaptive parthenogenesis in natural populations.
Well, I do think it's interesting they say most likely. I wonder exactly how unlikely it is. So could parthenogenesis in mammals like humans, is that essentially impossible or just so unlikely we wouldn't expect to see it?
Well, true. And then also the question is, like, what kind of time frame are we talking about? Are we talking about tomorrow or next year or 100 years from now, or are we looking at a longer history for our species?
Right. Wouldn't expect to see it over a population of X number.
Right. But then again, we're going beyond mere humans here, right? We're talking about mammals in general.
Yeah.
And so if we have no examples from the mammalian world that have presented themselves or have survived to present themselves to scientists today, then it does make you wonder.
I don't know. How many mammals other than humans could there be? What, you got dogs, you got rats. That's about it, isn't there?
Well, all the bat species. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, you have a considerable number of species to consider here. But yeah, if none of them are presenting an example of parthenogenesis, then I don't know. It seems like a pretty safe bet.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there you have it. Parthenogenesis, virgin birth, a little bit of holiday flair thrown in there. And I think just the big take home is that as always, when we're looking at something that is miraculous to humans, take it out to the animal world, and generally you're going to find that it's actually no big deal. there's much weirder stuff going on and plenty of examples of virgin birth going on, certainly in the invertebrate world, but then also in the vertebrate world as well.
It tends to remain the case that no myth, no magical story, no monster movie, no sci-fi special can come up with anything as weird as nature.
All right. So, hey, as always, if you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is our website. That is where you will find all of the episodes. You'll find links out to our social media accounts. You'll find a tab for our store where you can go check out some cool designs, get them on stickers, shirts, etc. It's a cool way to support the show. And if you want to support the show in a way that doesn't cost you any money, simply rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. And hey, check out Invention. Invention is the new podcast that we've launched. If you like Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you're going to love Invention as well. It publishes every Monday. And in each episode, Joe and I look at a different invention, a different revolution in technology, where it came from, how it came about, and how it's changed the world forever. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. If you search for Invention Podcast, you put in our names. You might want to throw in something like our names or throw in iHeartMedia, et cetera, iHeartRadio, and see if that helps the search results. But you can also find everything about it at InventionPod.com.
Big thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly with feedback on this episode or any other, to let us know a topic you'd like us to cover in the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Thank you.